Welcome to a special Bengals Beat Podcast four-part series presented by Cincinnati.com and Inquirer Sports. The Bengals don't currently have a Ring of Honor or a Hall of Fame, but that's not stopping us, the Inquirer, from discussing who would constitute an inaugural four-member class should the organization ever decide to start one. So over the next 4 weeks, one at a time, we'll pick the members of our class and sit down for a podcast conversation with them, rehashing memories, discussing the state of football, and, of course, the current Bengals. Enjoy the series. All right, welcome to the latest edition of our Cincinnati Inquirer Mythical Ring of Honor podcast series as we induct who would be our four Bengals players from the past to go into a Ring of Honor if the Bengals ever had one. Thus, hope you've enjoyed the ones we had thus far. Anthony Munoz was our number one, obviously. And last week, quarterback Kenny Anderson went in. Great conversations with those guys. Hope you enjoyed them. It's been really great catching up with everybody. After you get past those first two, though, it really gets into debate time. I think it starts to get pretty interesting. You can make a lot of arguments for a lot of different people for a number of reasons. But to me, the third person that we put in here in this series, when you start talking about quarterback MVPs, that's a pretty strong conversation starter. And when you start talking about quarterback MVPs that took a team to the Super Bowl and were 34 seconds away from knocking off Joe Montana for the team's only Super Bowl title, that's a strong argument. And for what Boomer Esiason meant to this franchise for a period of time, even though he spent a portion of his career elsewhere, I don't think you can deny him. So our third person in is former Bengals quarterback Boomer Esiason. Was the MVP of the league in 1988, threw for 27,000-plus yards with the Bengals, 187 touchdowns. 1995, Walter Payton, Man of the Year, went to four Pro Bowls. He was in the top two for adjusted net yards per attempt three different times as a Bengal. You just can't deny what he did and what he has certainly meant to the franchise. Not just on, but off the field as well. He's open and not afraid to be critical of it now in his role that he plays for CBS and all the other number of outlets that he does broadcasting for, but can't deny what he did on the field and has meant to this team. So without further ado, I bring you our conversation with the third member of our Cincinnati Inquirer, Cincinnati.com, Bengals Mythical Ring of Honor, Boomer Esiason.
All right, welcome back to the latest installment of our Cincinnati Inquirer Mythical Bengals Ring of Honor podcast series. I am happy to bring on our third edition as we bring in the 1988 MVP, Super Bowl 23, from CBS, Westwood One, Showtime. No stranger in Cincinnati on these parts, Boomer Esiason. Boomer, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Anything to talk about the 80s Bengals, always seem to have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, there's plenty too. In talking about players, some players from the 80s Bengals, our first two people that we put in as part of this four-person mythical Ring of Honor class were Anthony Munoz and Ken Anderson. I mean, you arrived, you came in 84 out of Maryland, and you eventually took over for Kenny, who was a franchise legend. But what were those early years like for you going through that transition in taking over it for a guy who had been there for forever?
I'm sure the guy that was in the middle of all that, the 23-year-old Boomer Esiason, was probably very frustrated that he couldn't get on the field earlier. But as a 55-year-old guy nowadays, I look back on those days extremely fondly. You know, Kenny Anderson couldn't have been a better teammate to me. As a quarterback, our backup quarterback at that time was Church Schoenert. He was a great friend. And then, of course, Sam Weiss and Bruce Coslett, our offense coordinator and head coach, really made the environment, I would say, very rich for a young quarterback like me to have some success. So all I had to do was kind of buy my time. I had to get through the frustration year of my rookie season, really not knowing what to do or what was expected of me. And then coming back in 1985 with basically armed with all the stuff that I had learned the year before, you know, it was kind of good for me. So Kenny was maybe one of the best things that had ever happened to me in the NFL.
What was the biggest takeaway for on the field from his game that really helped you early on?
Well, that's a really good question. There were a number of things about Kenny that I learned. Number one is how to prepare for an NFL football game, how to prepare a game plan or how to get taught a game plan, what to look for on film, how to practice, how to run a practice from a quarterback's perspective in the NFL. And then really what he was known for was his accuracy and how to be a pinpoint passer and how to throw the ball on time. So while my rookie year was, I would say, inconsistent at best, sitting there and watching one of the all-time greats in my estimation in terms of accuracy in the NFL really certainly helped me. So his overall professionalism, remember, I got there, I think he was in his 14th season. So I played 14 years in the NFL, so I can truly understand nowadays exactly where he was in his career, where you know, as opposed to where I was, and how fortunate I was to be able to learn from him.
You know, we've also spoken. We had a long conversation with Anthony Munoz. You know, I would say arguably, if not for certain, the best left tackle in NFL history. When you as a quarterback walk on the football field with 78 at left tackle, what is that presence like, and how does that change the way that you can play the game?
Well, it changes everything because most great pass rushers come from the defensive right side, the offensive left side. Now, whether or not that's just something that has happened over the years because there are more right-handed quarterbacks than left-handed quarterbacks, protecting the blind side, that type of thing, you know, that's up for debate with everybody else. But wherever your stud on the offensive line happens to be, and in this case, 78 was our left tackle, the other four guys benefit from it. The tight end benefits from it. The quarterback certainly benefits from it. The running game benefits from it. Defenses end up trying to attack you differently because of an all-pro, all-world, Hall of Fame-type talent. So not only was Anthony, did he have the reputation, he also had the work ethic to back it up. And, you know, Anthony was a great, great teammate. And, you know, when I got more established as the leader for the Cincinnati Bengals, anytime we had a down moment or a depressed moment or things weren't going well, and we need to have one of those players-only meetings, I would just plead with Anthony, please, please, please say something, because the guys are sick and tired of listening to me, and if it comes from you, then they will buy into it. And Anthony begrudgingly always did that for me and did that for us more importantly. So he was you're talking about two of the great Cincinnati Bengals of all time, and I was fortunate to play with both of them and be around both of them and certainly be exposed to what it meant to be a professional football player of the highest standard.
Yeah. You had Anthony there with that whole offensive line in 88. And could you tell me, that season obviously ended up being spectacular on a number of different levels. But, I mean, when you get with a team and prior to a season like that, did you have a sense or feeling that that would be a special year? Or did it kind of feel like the same as any others before the season started?
Well, it didn't feel the same because of what we were coming off the year before. Really, to truly understand the mid-'80s Bengals, you had to understand, first and foremost, the closeness of the team. I don't think that was ever a question. I really thought that we were a tight team for many different reasons. Now, in 1985, when I finally took over, I felt like we had an explosive offense that was just ready to burst onto the scene. 86, we followed up with more really good offensive numbers. We're an explosive offense. So 87 should have been the year that we went to the Super Bowl and really had a lot to play for. But unfortunately, the strike got in the way, and we were one of the teams, you know, that stuck together and therefore really cost us in the long run. We won 4-11 that year. And I think that's where we galvanized who we were as a football team. And then, of course, Sam Weish, you know, put black and white roommates together the next year, offensive and defensive roommates together in some cases, and really, really galvanized the team. And I'll never forget Sam's first comment that year, what are they going to do, fire me? So he kind of went into it with a, you know, nothing to lose attitude, and I think that's how we played. And I think we got out to either a 6-0 or 7-0 start. And as each game went by and we won each game, it became more and more apparent to us that this was going to be our year, regardless of what, you know, anybody else had predicted in regards to where we would finish the season.
You know, it seems to me Sam is probably one of the most underrated elements of not just that era, but coaches in general. I mean, do you kind of view what he did as sort of now looking back almost underappreciated? I mean, he was doing stuff that is commonplace, had been commonplace in the NFL forever, but then it really was revolutionary.
Well, you know, Sam was always an out-of-the-box thinker, and that's what kind of made him so unique. You know, in today's world, he's like the anti-Bill Belichick, you know. He's open to the media. He was open to the media. He was not afraid to, you know, give his feelings, not afraid to fight with the media at times. I always felt distracting the media. You know, if we lost a game here or a game there, you know, it was always about something else. It was never about us. It was never about the team. It was always about some other crazy thing that Sam had concocted. And I used to laugh at it and how the media would just buy it, you know, hook, line, and sinker. So from a football standpoint, extremely, extremely bright. And then when you put him with a coaching staff like Bruce Coslett, Jimmy Anderson, Jim McNally, Tiger Johnson on the offensive side of the football, which is where I really should talk. I really shouldn't talk about our defense. But, I mean, it was really brilliant. I mean, it was smart. I'll never forget in 1984 walking into the initial offensive meeting for the Bengals and sitting in that meeting room, Chris Collinsworth, Turk Schoner, Kenny Anderson, Max Montoya, Rodney Holman, Anthony Munoz, Steve Kreider, Pat McAnally. And these are some of the brightest guys the NFL has ever seen, and they're all sitting in one room. And now you add Sam to that mix, and I'm telling you, it was one of the smartest football teams I've ever been around.
Yeah. You know, that season obviously ends Super Bowl 23. There's been specials out on it, missing rings, and, you know, it, of course, it goes down as one of the best Super Bowls of all time. What's a clearer memory for you of Super Bowl 23? Is it watching Stanford Jennings run back to kickoff, or is it still Montana to Taylor, who is always the clearest?
Well, you know, the farther you get away from it, the more you realize just how special a time it was. And Stanford was my roommate. You know, Stanford and I roomed together. You know, I watched him go through the excruciating frustration of not being able to be with his wife, Kathy, for the birth of their daughter, Kelsey, the day before, and how happy he was and how proud he was. And, you know, the fact that he ran a kickoff back the next day was just amazing for all of us to take part in. Because Stanford was one of the more liked and appreciated guys on the team because he was underrated. He wasn't James Brooks. He wasn't Icky Woods. He wasn't Stanley Wilson. But he did a little bit of everything in every aspect of our offensive and special teams game. So everybody loved him. And then, of course, there is the, you know, the final drive with Joe Montana and all that other stuff. And this thing of that has kind of worn off over the years, and I kind of have fun with Joe with it now. But at the end of the day, you know, a kid out of East High School, Long Island, was a second-round draft pick of the Cincinnati Bengals. Somehow, some way, found his way onto the field for a Super Bowl. And that's a memory that I will cherish forever and never forget and never look back on it with anything other than fondness.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. A lot of people, we have a younger generation of people that are learning about the 80s Bengals now and things like that. And, you know, people forget you came back and had an incredible run in the conclusion of the 97 season with the Bengals where you had 13 touchdowns, you just two picks, you're 4-1, and you know, two times you get a score over 40 points. After that season, how close were you to coming back instead of moving into the booth? And what were those conversations like as you were making those decisions and talking it over with Mike in the front office?
Yeah, I really was close to coming back. I mean, I loved my time that last year. And Bruce Coslett was now my head coach. Kenny Anderson was my offensive coordinator, quarterback coach. And it was like the perfect situation for me, a veteran quarterback who knew the offense as well as the coaches did. Unfortunately for Jeff Blake, he was struggling that year. And believe you me, when the season was over, man, I was just so hyped and so jacked and so proud of what we were able to accomplish that it really did take a lot to take me off the football field. But I think I was a realist at the time. I kind of remember telling Mike Brown, look, if you want to give me some contract that I can't say no to and then I'll come back, then I would do that. And that would have been a significant amount of money at that time. And this was going to be the third year in a row, I believe, that I was offered the Monday Night Football analyst job. And if I didn't get it then, I don't necessarily know that I would have ever gotten it after that. But it was a great run for me that at the end of that season. My young teammates, really, I mean, they all bought into what I was selling. And to watch guys like Corey Dillon and Kajana Carter and James Hunden and David Dunn and Marco Battaglia and all these guys just absolutely get to a whole nother level that I don't even think they thought was possible was probably one of the most satisfying aspects of finishing up as a Cincinnati Bengal.
You know, since then, maybe, and even during some of that time, I mean, what you became in a lot of ways known for was all your work with cystic fibrosis. And now Gunner's a BC grad. He's sort of on the front lines of the battle himself. What's it like for you to watch him emerge and be picking up that, you know, right behind you or alongside you, really, in that regard now?
It's really amazing. You know, there's a lot of pressure on him, and this is not a fight that he chose. You know, he was obviously born with this disease. We decided to make it a national story. He did not have any say in that as a two-year-old. And now to watch him 23 years later as a 25-year-old doing what he's doing, you know, accepting the mantle of being the face for cystic fibrosis and trying to do something about it, try to raise money and try to advocate on behalf of cystic fibrosis patients worldwide. I couldn't be any more proud of him and what he's accomplished. For me, it's like he's won 5 Super Bowls, if you want to put it into the athletic terms. And he is an amazing kid and an amazing young man, and he has a very, very bright future. And you would have never said that 25, 30 years ago in the world of cystic fibrosis, but now we can say that.
How can people know how they can go and help and still, you know, give to the foundation? What's the best way for them to do that now?
The easiest place is assiacin.org. They can read about all the different programs that we have. They can read about who our board members are, you know, what we put our money into, how we try to make a difference, how we have made a difference. There's also testimonials in there from other cystic fibrosis patients from all around the world that have benefited from our hard work and our diligence. And, you know, as a dad of a CF patient, all I can say is that the thing that means most to me is taking that money and having the biggest impact that I possibly can have in the world of CF patients, and whether it be supporting Cincinnati Children's Hospital with the Gunner Esiason Pediatric Center, New York Presbyterian with the Gunner Esiason Adult Cystic Fibrosis Center, or over $35 million invested in drug development, which all these patients are benefiting from now, we will always and continue to make the right decisions with the money that we receive.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I'd be remiss to not talk to you about the Bengals and Andy Dalton real quick. I mean, you know, he spent much of last year before he got hurt, even in the MVP conversation, which a lot of people never would have seen coming. Do you feel like watching him that he's taken the next step, or do you need to see more to believe that he can be a guy that can take this team all the way to the franchise's third Super Bowl?
You know, I don't need to see anymore. You know, I know what I see. I know the high character that he has. Much like me, he was a second-round draft choice. You know, Kenny Anderson was a third-round draft choice. You know, Kenny, you know, played in the shadows of guys like Dan Fouts and you know, Bradshaw. I played in the shadows of guys like, you know, Dan Marino and John Elway. And Andy's in the generation now where he's playing in the shadows of guys like Brady and Manning as last names. So, he is a quality, high-end quarterback. He's a terrific kid. He's a guy that's an all-in type of guy. The amount of money that they have invested in him with the production that they've gotten from him is one of the best ratios in all of the NFL. And I do believe that he has better places and higher places to get to, but I don't have to see that in order to cement my sense that he's a true NFL quarterback in the real sense that he can lead his team to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, you know, we just saw Cleveland Cavs win a title. Finally, Cleveland gets their title. Now people start talking about the playoff loss, drought to the Bengals. I mean, how much do you think something like that, I mean, when you played, something that even if it was a recent history of things, how much of history and struggling to get over a hump mentally weigh on a team? Or is that something that you feel like players are pretty good at being able typically to put that stuff behind them and not let it be an issue?
Well, you know, what I remember most is that every year is a year all into itself. And in order to get to a certain point, whether it be a Super Bowl or championship game or really to make it to the playoffs, considering whatever the hump may be, there are a lot of things that got to go right, you know. And I thought last year the Bengals had everything going right, and then Andy, you know, broke his finger and or broke his thumb or whatever it was. And even though A.J. McCarron stepped in and played what I think is, you know, really well, really accorded himself very well, it was not like having Andy Dalton back there. And even if other injuries did occur, you knew you had your starting quarterback, your starting wide receiver, your starting running back, and you can go out there and play with anybody. And it's unfortunate that, you know, that had to happen. I don't think it lingers. I really don't. I think, you know, once they get the training camp, you know, it starts over again. Everybody's fresh. Everybody's new. There'll be some new guys. There'll be some new injuries that will, you know, the team will have to deal with like every other team in the NFL. And you know what? You just try to get on a roll. That's the key. You win one game, you win the second game, you win the third game. And once you get on that roll, the most powerful ingredient, I believe, for, you know, any professional sports team or any sports team in general is the power of confidence. And, you know, that's what the Bengals have to do. They got to get off to a good start and rebuild whatever confidence that they may have lost and start all over again on what I think will be a definitely a playoff year. And if they make the playoffs, then they're like everybody else. They got a chance to go get a Super Bowl.
Yep. Well, the last thing I got to ask you, since we're doing our, we have much debate over these rings of honor and things like that. We have Anthony, Ken Anderson, now you, and the last and final fourth name, there is debate, plenty to be had. Names like Isaac Curtis, Ken Riley, Willie Anderson, Corey Dillon, Chad Johnson. Anthony even said Max Montoya would be certainly on his list. Who you got? Who would be your fourth person in if you were picking a class of a Bengals Ring of Honor?
Well, you also forgot, you know, I think the 1981 Rookie of the Year, Chris Collinsworth, three-time Pro Bowler,
yep,
who obviously has gone on to great things. You know, there are a lot of great players, and I think four is unfair. You know, when I go around the league and I do Monday Night Football and I go into all these stadiums, all I can tell you is that they have, you know, many guys representing every single team. And, you know, when I go back to the Steelers, they'll always have 15 to 20 guys in their jerseys out there celebrating the great Steeler teams. And it's unfortunate that we don't do that as a Cincinnati Bengal organization, but all those names that you just named right there are more than worthy to be a part of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're trying to do our part to get it kickstarted a little bit more and keep it running and keep the team certainly honoring a past that is, you know, the history and tradition is growing more and more every single year now, especially during this run, which has been one of the most successful that they've ever had. Boomer, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us, and it's been great talking to you. Congratulations on everything that you've been able to do on and off the field.
My pleasure, Paul.